Welcome to Audio Gyan with Kedar Nimkar, a podcast that documents insightful conversations with Indian designers, artists, musicians, writers, thinkers, and creatives of all types. Catch us on iTunes or visit audiogyan.com for more Gyan sessions. Here's your host, Kedar Nimkar.
Today, I have Pavitra Shri Prakash with us on Audio Gyan. She's an architect and urban designer with a focus on sustainability. Pavitra is the chief designer and director at the Global Design Studio of Shilpa Architects, which is an acclaimed design house based in Chennai. Having practiced urban design and planning in New York and Chicago, Pavitra's work has been India-focused since 2008. I'm really pleased and privileged to have you on the show, and welcome to Audio Gyan, Pavitra.
Excellent. I'm really looking forward to giving you my little gyan on architecture and sustainability. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks for setting the background here. We'll be discussing about architecture and various aspects when it comes to designing spaces. So I would like to start by asking, in one of your interviews, you mentioned that before you begin a project, you have to identify soul of the project. So can you tell us what is a soul of a project and how do you go about identifying it?
Okay, I was just going to say we are starting off with this really heavy stuff. So in general, soul searching, you know, is not something that's the most easy thing that's out there. And as human beings, we use the word soul so much, and a large majority of us actually just go through life without even being in touch with our own souls. So nowadays, if you think about it, so much of growing importance on soul realization and the links between meditation and higher levels of thinking. And it's finally on the radar of so many big clinical studies at like massive universities like Harvard. And here we are, you know, sitting in India, a culture that has known the benefits of all of this for so many centuries. And still there are so many of us that go through life so cluelessly without finding our own soul. So I think I have an interesting story. I still remember the first lecture where, you know, I was in a spiritual lecture, and the teacher was attempting to get us all to understand, you know, the answer to the question fundamentally, who am I? And, you know, getting everybody to think about it's not the body, it's not the mind, it's not your thoughts, you know, that kind of thing, and trying to really focus on your inner voice. I think when it comes to an architectural project, I mean, identifying the soul is just about as complex, because when you look at an architectural building or any built form, what you see is the equivalent of, say, the human body. It is the infrastructure, right? It is the overall sort of space within which everything happens. And it is armed with all the correct services. It's armed with water supply and, you know, air conditioning and all these other things, which are equivalent to all our, you know, organ systems. But there is inherently something that underlying every architectural project that truly makes it come alive, that makes it turn from just any other space into a place which has like memory and which kind of, you know, evokes a certain emotional response from the people that are going to be inside this building. So I guess when it comes to finding the architectural soul of any project, you have to look at the context. We also look very closely at, like, you know, the identity that this building is going to have and is going to, like, you know, have a lasting impression on for the next, you know, typically any building has a lifespan of anywhere between 50 to 80 years, you know, that's what we say. But, you know, that identity that it has through its lifespan in terms of how it responds to the culture of the people, of the geography. And when you look at, you know, user centricity and functionality of a building, it is again akin to the earlier example of a human body analogy that I was trying to say. You know, it is just the body of it. When you're looking at the functional aspects, does it have a room to perform this task or the other? Whereas the soul of the project is really that sort of, you know, inherent quality that you can't quite put a finger on, but it is that which, when you enter a space, you kind of get a feeling of, you know, wow, I am connected to this space. I have a kind of emotional response to this space that I have not had anywhere else. And, you know, I think all of us have experienced this. And usually these happen in like, you know, very either open spaces or like very monumental spaces where automatically you have an emotional response of being in a space of awe or wonderment or, you know, feeling, you know, like looking up at the ceiling and wondering how greatly it's been done and, you know, things like that. And I think historically, and if you study architectural history around the world, the idea was always to try and make the human being feel kind of really small so that, you know, you feel like, you know, you look up and you are just sort of lost in the space, whether it's examples of temples or the pyramids or cathedrals. There was always this upward movement that kind of happened. I mean, that's obviously in grandiose, over-the-top architecture. But in today's context, it's about actually giving a building that sense of identity as well as connect to someone when they walk in. So now I wanted to talk to you really little about a particular project. Now I'm going to talk about a recreation center that we were creating within a new town development, like just outside of the city of Chennai, which is home for me. So the idea here was space where people come out in the evening to unwind and to relax. So this entire new SEZ, which has, you know, the corporate headquarters for big names like Nissan and BMW and all these other, like, you know, IT companies, where people are pretty much like working 9 to 5 and, you know, putting in their day. A recreation area is an area where they come to at the end of the day to sort of, you know, just let loose and just, you know, connect back to their soul. So in many ways, I was lucky to be designing the soul of the entire city for them, by really and truly connecting the space to nature, because the site was really scenic and we kind of took advantage of the geography of it. And the entire celebration was done around the movement of water, because I think it is something that is so intrinsically beautiful about the way water moves. So here on this particular site, we were located between a mountain and a lake and the natural water course that kind of went through the site. So the entire design became a celebration of the movement of water. So right from how it is trapped from the roof of the building to being brought down, everything was treated like, you know, poetry and becomes something that every day is seen by the people that come to this sort of, you know, to this building and to this space. So apart from coming here to just sort of, you know, let loose, relax at the end of a long working hour day, you come here and you also get to experience this natural phenomenon of water that leaves the sky and then gets connected down into the ground.
That's really interesting. But if you can ponder a little more on this, I understand that historical places might have memories and other events attached to the place, which relates to the thought of having a soul. But how does that work when you're starting something fresh? So how do you identify a soul in that case?
Well, as I said, I think, you know, it is a complex process, and it is something that is almost rooted with connecting the building to its context, to bringing about some sort of identity, to making sure that it's responsive to its geography, and at the same time, you know, gives you a sense of connect. At the end of the day, when people connect to a building or have an emotional response to it, then you can almost say that it feels like something that you empathize with, something that you react to, rather than just sort of, you know, passively moving in and out through spaces in a very sort of, you know, machine assembly line sort of way. This becomes something where you share a certain emotion with. And that is what it means to sort of try and bring about spaces and design spaces or design elements of a building that can give you that sense of being connected to it or give you an appreciation of what it does or how it functions on a day-to-day basis.
You also mentioned spaces being responsive to the users. Can you explain what do you mean by that?
Right. I mean, I think when you say a space is responsive to its users, there are several different levels on which a space can be responsive to its users. I mean, typically, the more direct application of this is when a space is being built for a specific target audience. Like, for an example, you can say, like, you know, if we're designing a primary school, the design itself is responsive to its users. It's more in scale with toddlers and young kids. or if you're designing spaces for, say, older people, then you have spaces which are then, you know, accessible, easy to access, ramps, you know, having universal access principles, which then make it a lot more, again, responsive to its users. But then you can think about specialized spaces like, you know, hospitals and theaters, which are again designed to suit certain types of usage. Whereas what I was trying to get at when I was talking about being responsive to users is something that I just touched upon in your previous question also, is about the kind of emotion that a space evokes or the certain feeling that it gives to you as a response, as an audience or as a person entering that space. Like, a really great example of this is, I think, one of these things that I actually visited just very recently in Berlin. There is the Jewish Museum, which was built by Daniel Liebskind. It's a very, very famous building. And if you think about it, the entire experience of being in that museum is supposed to evoke memories of the Holocaust. And this is done purely through the manipulation of space by, you know, having the scale, having spaces that have are completely devoid of sound, which are completely insulated, which have just a single source point of light that, you know, are almost from just in one corner of the room, that's like your little ray of hope. But, you know, the kind of feeling that you have when you're in a space like that is exactly what I mean by saying, if you have a project which has a very well-designed soul or a very well-designed, you know, purpose, then it definitely evokes that emotional connect with anybody who enters that building or space.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely. Pavitra, the next thing which I wanted to ask you is that I've been to few forts in the Sahyadri range, some palaces in Mysore and other parts of the country. And what I observed was that they are really intense, rich and much evolved in design. As you mentioned, that light coming in from one part of the room, one part, but still illuminating the entire room, or water reservoirs, keeping the water cool and clean, even in extreme temperature. So the question is, if we had such developed skills, why isn't it seen in the modern architecture? I mean, why don't we have places designed like the old architecture?
Well, I think that this is a fundamental question that will rock anybody who's practicing architecture in our country today. And I think that, you know, there is so much to look back to and sort of celebrate our past and sort of learn from it, that it feels like the future is somewhat, like you mentioned it mildly, bleak. but you know, at the end of the day, I think what has happened with the building and sort of the entire real estate industry itself is that, you know, forts and palaces used to be celebrations. They used to be extravagant, sort of, you know, almost over the top buildings which used a whole lot of ornamentation, and there was a lot of attention to detail that went into, you know, trying to make a statement. Like, every building back in the day, if you look at it, you know, one palace was always trying to outdo the other palace. There was always a sense of, you know, let's make it bigger, better, more grand. You know, there was that constant, that sense of sort of almost cultural pride or I don't know, whatever else you'd want to call it, but that it used to be there. And nowadays, if you think about it, the entire movement of building has kind of evolved to sort of almost respect a certain different discipline, right? Because now we're tended toward minimalism. Like, nobody wants to go in for so much ornamentation anymore, or, you know, do the kind of intricate work that we used to, because honestly, in today's culture, it seems too time consuming and too sort of tedious to sort of, you know, have this level of, you know, architectural detailing going into any building. But what does and what should still be preserved, I think, in my respect, is the fact that we are moving towards minimalism, understanding fully well that, you know, by doing so, we are respecting our resources and our geography. Yes, that has to still be maintained. But what should not be lost is that sense of creating spaces, working with lighting, working with different aspects of, you know, just your natural setting to make a place feel beautiful. So I think nowadays it's more about architecture tending towards earth and nature harmonious ways rather than looking for a grand ostentatious statement. And that is the cusp we are at, and we have to navigate very well and seamlessly.
Mm-hmm. But are designers and architects borrowing concepts which are really good in old architecture while they are building new structures and new buildings in the current time?
Well, I think there are aspects of it that can definitely be borrowed. I can talk to you again from a certain example. So, for example, we recently completed an office building that looks at, you know, 100% daylighting within the space. So, you know, naturally bringing in sources of light and, you know, the idea to sort of sell this to our client in today's market was to tell them that, hey, you'll have a zero energy bill when it comes to lighting because you're not going to be spending any money on lighting. So that is very appealing for a client today to hear. But by doing that, we have automatically been able to bring about, you know, a sensibility in how the windows are designed, where they are placed, how the light streams through. And we've taken into account, you know, aspects of design that work in today's context for today's clients. So I think it's about, you know, obviously borrowing from tradition and from ideas of history that we have seen. Obviously, these are things that we have seen. It's what shapes your sensibilities going forth into a world of design. But at the same time, it has to sort of be, I guess, packaged in a way in which it becomes acceptable or palatable to your market and client and customer today.
Nice. Pavitra, I would like to slightly change tracks here and ask you something which you have been working on. And again, in one of your interviews, I read you were talking about geography playing an important part when it comes to building structures. So can you tell us what's the role of geography in architecture?
Well, I think any structure or any building relies very heavily on its site. Because without the site, that is the first thing as an architect to ask the question, what is the site? Does it have contours? Does it have any existing vegetation on it? Does it have, you know, what is the orientation? Is it north facing, south facing? You know, these become very important basic parameters with which anybody is expected to start building. Because unless you have a site, you don't have a plate on which to put your building, right? So, I mean, it is your basis, it's your foundation. So when it comes to terrain, obviously, there is a lot of respect that is given to the terrain. You have to be able to respect contours. You have to be able to respect existing trees. So all of these things become sort of part and parcel of the design. You try and incorporate it as far as possible. So when you look at taking the role of geography into like the next level, which is what we try to do through a sustainable design practice, such as ours here at Shilpa Architects, what we try to do is we bring in a process of making sure that we study aspects such as, you know, site drainage. I spoke to you about another building where it just celebrates the way the water moves, right? Whether it's moving from the sky down into like the drain or whether it's moving from along its natural course, you know, you study all these aspects that then become a part of the building. If you look at one of the most interesting examples from history of architecture, there is one building called Falling Water by this architect called Frank Lloyd Wright, which actually is a house that's built on top of a river outside of Pittsburgh in the United States. So it becomes about, you know, inviting this natural setting that you are given by virtue of having a site and making it a part of the building and making it a part of that emotional response that you can have within this building. Another great example where we did this is we have a lot of these projects that we're working on in the Middle East. And what happens in climatic conditions in like in Saudi Arabia and in the Middle East, where we're looking at sites that, you know, have high exposure to like heat and radiation, is that designing the facade of the building becomes very, very important. And how much heat do you let in while balancing it with the light and sort of balancing that parameter of bringing in natural light cutting down the amount of energy you need to light a building, and then, you know, at the same time, keeping the heat out and managing to use less energy while cooling the building, right? So I think this sort of balance of that entire weather and sort of climatic data show that, you know, a building design goes through this entire geography process where a weather file is, you know, set up and you study the shadows, you study the angles. We also study rainfall and wind data to make sure that, you know, nothing that the building does is against the face of anything that nature will present to it at this particular site.
Wow, that's too intense. I mean, I can hardly imagine how complex the process would be.
Absolutely.
Because here you're playing with the nature itself, right?
Right. So I think this is something else that I really like to say to students. And I work with students of architecture a lot because, you know, it is mandatory for them to have a one-year internship. And invariably at our studio, we have like some interns and young students of architecture. There is always this fear that, you know, your architecture can be copied because this is something that, you know, you put out there for the world to see. And at the same time, it's a two-way street because, you know, people also tend to copy a lot of architecture and copy a lot of architectural ideas. So my response to that is if you create for a particular site, respecting its geography, for its people or for the inhabitants, along with the idea that you're trying to infuse a unique identity or a soul for this project, it doesn't matter where in the world you're creating this. It will be a unique creation, and there is no way in which you can copy it or it can ever be replicated because it's a solution that is so customized to sort of, you know, work for that one place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this also connects to the point of being responsive to the users since you're building for the people in a particular geography, which always will be unique.
Right, exactly. And what's really amazing is I think for the first time right now, and you're talking about architecture being responsive to users, for the first time in my career, which is, you know, a little over a decade and a half right now, the first time I've managed to do actually design for users that are non-human. So I'm actually designing a sanctuary for animals, and it covers all kinds of animals, right? From dogs and cats to cattle to horses to ponies to ducks to pigs. And, you know, each one of these right now for me is an individual user and an individual sort of response or spatial requirement that it does need. So it's absolutely fantastic to just understand how all of these sort of other sentient beings also have spatial requirements that need to be cared for.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. All the best for your work there. Pavitra, I would like to conclude with one last question, which is very closely associated with the kind of work you do, which is sustainability. I understand this is a big chapter and might require another AudioGAN, but if you can share some basics of how to build sustainable cities or sustainable areas from an architect's point of view.
Well, when you look at sustainability, it's such a broad umbrella, right? It's almost as broad as architecture because it's covering so many different sort of angles that almost everything can be made sustainable. And when it comes to city design and it comes to architecture, we are looking at, you know, a lot of sustainable infrastructure that kind of needs to go in. Because I think the sustainability movement in our country as well as many other countries around the world has focused largely on individual buildings. So, you know, individual buildings are becoming greener and more sustainable, more conscious of their usage of energy and other resources, whereas the very fabric of the city within which it sits may or may not be the most sustainable or the most, you know, conducive to sustainability. So I think when you are looking at it from a city's point of view, it's more about trying to make all the city level infrastructure very, very sustainable. And that would mean looking at usage and reuse as well as recycling of resources at a much larger scale
than you are doing on a building level. So I think it comes down to bigger issues of, you know, moving people or having mobility or having, you know, urban transportation solutions that can then, you know, be work. Yes, I think our biggest thing in India has always been and continues to be sanitation, like you rightly said, which covers both, you know, sanitation in terms of bathrooms and how it is done hygienically and how you manage sewage and sewerage systems, as well as solid waste management, which is something that's kind of, you know, plaguing all our big cities right now. So then it comes down to what is the infrastructure that exists today in our cities to manage this solid waste? Where are we building spaces to manage our garbage? And people think about this. We rarely think about what happens to something once we toss it out of our home. What is the life that little piece of plastic or that plastic disposable spoon has had after it leaves your home or your plate? So, you know, I think this then becomes a very, you know, city-oriented question. But it's been a big part of, I think, my own sustainability learning to try and see how to make sustainability something that is not such a large looming problem that you can't even think of how to be a part of the solution, but you just sort of leave it saying, you know, hey, this is too big for me to deal with. I can't possibly come up with a way in which, you know, the city manages its garbage. But it comes down to making certain choices and having better habits that can then sort of affect the entire supply chain of this whole thing. You know, it's almost an entire ecosystem that then starts with each individual user. So I always go back to people and I say, you know, when you start thinking about sustainability as a problem or as, like, you know, as an issue that you want to think about how you can make that small change, whether it is, you know, installing a faucet that uses less water in your home or looking at, you know, how many times a week you choose to take a shower versus taking a bath with a bucket, you know, the old-fashioned. All of this starts at home before it starts becoming a city's problem.
Hmm. So there are initiatives where, like things like rainwater harvesting or better sewage disposal happening in pockets of the country. But what you're saying is that it should happen in city, at a city infrastructure level also, right?
Right. And I think that, you know, there are basically five sort of parameters when it comes to sustainability that everybody looks at. You look at a site or you look at, like, you know, the land. You look at water and its efficiency and its usage. You look at energy. You look at the kind of materials that we use, the kind of renewable or recycled component that it has. And then you look at, you know, the overall quality in terms of air quality or water quality and, you know, all the other resource quality that you can get. So I think just an extension of whatever we apply on a building level basis, if it is applied on a city level basis, looking purely at infrastructure, not looking at individual sort of, you know, plots of development. I think that is where our cities need to start with when it comes to sustainability.
Mm-hmm. I hope even the government realizes the importance and takes some initiatives in this direction.
But it's definitely a two-way street. I mean, there has to be the government, which are doing a top-down approach, but it also has to come from the people that intrinsic want to change and to not treat this as something that is too large, you know, a planetary issue that they can't really contribute to, but do everything that you can on your daily lifestyle to make sure that you adopt something that's more sustainable.
Yeah, sure. So I think this is a good note to end this. I know there are plenty of things to be discussed around architecture, spaces, and more importantly, sustainability. I hope to have you again on AudioGAN, Pavitra, and where you can share some more insights to our listeners. It was a pleasure talking to you. And thanks once again for giving us your time.
It's been a total pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on AudioGAN.
So that was Pavitra Shriprakash with us from Shilpa Architect, a Chennai-based design house working on sustainability and urban planning. And that's it from today's GAN session. Stay tuned for more GAN on AudioGAN next week. Till then, bye.